Hey, it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For 15 years, writer Tamara Dean lived off the land in the heart of Wisconsin's Driftless region, known for its rolling hills and bluffs and deep river valleys carved from sandstone.
Tamara and her partner David spent that time homesteading and finding beauty and adventure in every corner of their 275-acre property.
In a new book of essays, Tamara Dean gives us a glimpse into all she's learned from her time in the Driftless area, including her quickly corrected misconceptions of what it's like to homestead with your partner. The book is called Shelter and Storm. Tamara, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. You write that the Driftless area is so improbable that some geologists refuse to accept it. Why is this area of land in southwestern Wisconsin so incredibly special?
It's one of the few areas in the world that was never touched by glaciers, but it's also the only area in the world that has no obvious explanation for that. All of North America's glaciers flowed around this area, but it's not higher than other places. It's not more porous around it. So even when other geologists had confirmed there's no evidence of drift, which is the debris like rocks and silt and sand that glaciers plow down as they move forward and then leave behind as they recede. Geologists out east, for example, was saying, well, this is just not possible. And even a geologist at the University of Wisconsin would not believe it. And he kept going out to this area, digging, looking for drift, but there just wasn't any.
Why do you think people are called to this region, especially new homesteaders?
I think, like I was, they're just seduced by this magical landscape. It's unlike any other place in the Midwest. It has these steep limestone bluffs and gorgeous, sparkling, spring-fed streams. It has narrow river valleys. That's what drew me initially. I didn't understand the history or the culture behind it. But soon that, too, presented itself as a reason to move there. It's a close-knit community. It's an area where a lot of alternative practices are going on from, you know, the organic farming that is really supported by Organic Valley, which is headquartered in that area, to alternative building and energy projects. It's an area, at least when we moved there, had no real zoning laws in our township. So, you know, if you wanted to build a house out of tires, you could. If you wanted to build a house out of wine bottles, you could do that.
Or if you want to build a house out of compressed earth blocks, go right ahead.
That's right.
Which you did. What was that like?
We did. We had tried out other methods of construction, including straw bale. That was how we made our wood shop. But it turned out that straw bales were not practical in this humid river valley. So we looked around for other options. What we wanted was something eco-friendly that we imagined could, you know, disappear into the earth long after we're gone. So we knew a guy who had a machine for making these compressed earth blocks. And basically, they're a combination of clay subsoil, which we dug when we put in our rainwater cistern and our septic system, and then sand, which we got for free for the hauling, really, from the dredging of the Mississippi. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers is always dredging that river for shipping lanes. And then a little bit of Portland cement to harden it and make it cure. And we made over 7,200 bricks or compressed earth blocks. They had to cure for a little while. And then we made a double masonry wall of these blocks. And in between, in the gap, we poured perlite insulation. So the walls were super insulated and thick. They kept the warmth in the winter, and they kept the house cool in the summer. So they worked in a very eco-friendly way.
How good were you at laying bricks?
Oh, you found that part in the book. I was terrible. I didn't understand how much skill it takes to work masonry. Mm. And I don't know if it's just my own lack of depth perception or what, but it was pretty bad. I did lay blocks in one area of the living room, but I could tell that wall was a little skewed.
What did your neighbors think?
Well, you'd have to ask them, truly. I heard a little gossip while we were building. But as the structure went up, we had so many visitors, and they were so curious. And one thing I learned about living in the country is, you know, people will just walk into your house and look around, especially if it's not finished. But we had visitors come along for years and ask for tours, and they were all so amazed by what we'd done. You know, the house had the mud brick walls, but it also had a central fireplace, a central stove made out of rocks that we had gathered from the hills on our property. And, you know, it had wood cabinets made from the trees on our property. So it was really beautiful.
We're talking about Shelter in Storm. It's a new book of essays by Wisconsin author Tamara Dean. It's reflecting on life in the Driftless region of Wisconsin. The first essay in your book, it's called So Near the Soil, and it addresses what it's like to try farming. And it's something that you had never done before, and you start off really confident and really hopeful. What were some of the challenges that surprised you most as an entry-level farmer?
Right. I had the impression that because I came from a long line of farmers, you know, all the way back in municipal records and family stories, that somehow I would be born with this understanding of how to grow crops. Of course, that was naive. And I started with a large garden, but gardens and crops are entirely different. When I looked out at my neighbor's fields, I was trying to also do the math. You know, could I grow 40 acres of organic, diverse vegetables and fruits? I didn't want to grow the commodity crops like corn and soybeans, but I also found out from asking around and studying what neighbors were doing that commodity crops are supported by the USDA through subsidies and grants and crop insurance. And at that time, there was no safety net for growers of organic mixed crops like vegetables and fruits. And I saw some of our neighbors get entirely wiped out year after year because of these record-breaking floods that the Driftless area was experiencing. And I thought, I don't have the risk tolerance for this kind of lifestyle, and I don't understand how a person can make the bottom line positive growing the kinds of things that I wanted to grow.
Yes, because you had tried to, or you had planned to trade writing for farming and make a living as a farmer, but then you put that together and you meet with the USDA and try to chart out a plan for what to do with this land, and it just doesn't pencil out.
Yeah, and another thing about USDA subsidies is that they're given to large agribusinesses. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the kind of land that allowed for that kind of business. So those USDA programs weren't as helpful to me as they would be to, you know, a giant CAFO or conglomerate farm.
And you call yourself a steward of the land, not like a property owner. And I wonder if that distinction made it more difficult to decide what to do with these acres.
I think you're pointing to the fact that I can overthink anything. yeah, that's true. I thought of myself as a steward in part because I understand that everything about land, our idea of its use and where the boundaries are and who gets to use it and who gets to speak for it and whose history is, you know, authorized, is political. I didn't feel entitled to take ownership of land in that same way. I wanted to be able to question and to learn and adapt. So ultimately, I was intrigued by the pollinator habitat grants that President Obama instituted, I think it was in 2014, when everyone recognized that bees and butterflies and other pollinators were in trouble, and they're necessary for growing larger crops, any crops. And so I did take advantage of one of those USDA grants to plant an old hay field into a new prairie.
In terms of the prairie, in your essay, Fire and Time, you talk about conducting controlled burns on your property to start to restore a prairie to prepare for the reintroduction of native grasses and flowers. And you take us through these burns and one when it's losing control and then you get it back under control and you're just baffled by how this works. Can you tell us about the experience of a controlled burn?
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, you mow and dig these lanes or alleys so that their fire breaks. We burned this old hay field in four sections, and I thought that would be more controlled. I don't know if that was really true, but a few of the burns went flawlessly. And then one, when we decided we could do it ourselves without our neighbor's help, without the help of experts, did almost get out of control. We had thought our final burn was just flawless, too. Like the first burn, we had our friends helping at that time, and everybody agreed this was a perfect burn. And then about an hour later, when my partner went up to the hilltop to just retrieve the tractor and check on everything, he found that the whole ridgetop was on fire at the edges and moving toward the neighbor's property. And he called me with his cell phone back at home about a mile away. I was already starting to nap. And he said, "I'm not panicking, but the fire has gone to the woods in this direction. It's gone to our neighbor's field in that direction, and we need help." And to the credit of our neighbors, I called them and I said, "Can we get that equipment we borrowed back from you?" And they said, "We're coming to help. We had plans this evening, but this is our plan now." And they did. And we extinguished the fire without much more drama, except that that night, an old ash tree that was hollow in the middle was on fire and spraying sparks about 100 feet in the air. Not really harmful because all the ground around it had already been charred, but it was dramatic.
But there's a difference between good fires and bad fires. And you write about when fire is withheld or suppressed, that prairies stagnate. Can you talk a little bit more? Because in our heads, we think that, you know, fires can be really harmful, and yet we need them.
Right. The prairies do need fires to keep down the woody brush that would otherwise dominate and prevent the other native flora and other species from thriving. So fire is both necessary, but it's fraught sometimes.
You now live in Madison, and hearing about all the work you put into this land in the Driftless area, all of these memories and stories, why did you decide to leave?
It was a heartbreaking decision. But some people know of the Driftless area as the Midwest's epicenter for Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. And unfortunately, you know, spending so much time in prairies and meadows and gardens and woods out in the Driftless area, I did often get bitten by ticks. And I had several cases of Lyme disease. The last one, which I noticed starting around 2016, ended up lasting almost 5 years. I think it might be like the long COVID cases that people are talking about, where you just don't have energy or you don't know from day to day whether you'll be able to get out of bed and function. And it was impossible for me to maintain the energy for our lifestyle, which included, you know, chopping wood and mowing and pruning trees and planting and harvesting and
very
putting up
physical.
Produce. Yes.
Yeah. 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 Since leaving the Driftless, I wonder, you know, all of these essays have the common thread of this region, of this glorious region. And I'm wondering, as a writer, was it hard to write about something else?
Life in the Driftless area seemed to present constant drama. You know, all I had to do was step outside, it seemed, and I would be presented with something astonishing, good or bad, or just curious and weird. So the material kept coming. And initially, when I moved to the Driftless area, I was a fiction writer and a technical writer, but not really an essayist. And then I thought, well, the drama here, you know, overshadows any kind of fictional storyline. But it turns out that I have had more material come toward me about 6 months after we left the Driftless area. I was walking across the street in Minneapolis, and I was run over by an SUV. And I wrote about that experience and the recovery and pedestrian rights. And then, you know, more things keep happening. And I'm still astonished by nature. One thing I took with me from the Driftless area was that if you're open-hearted and open-minded as you're walking through the outdoors or interacting with neighbors and your community, you're bound to be rewarded with, you know, insights and wonder.
Tamara, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Tamara Dean's new essay collection is called Shelter in Storm. The book is about the 15 years she and her partner spent living off the land in the Driftless area. And Tamara is on a book tour around Wisconsin with events on April 26th in Viroqua, May 1st in La Crosse, and May 9th in Egg Harbor, among the stops.